You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, when longtime Milwaukee journalist Gail Garbarino Cullen's husband Steve was just 40, he died unexpectedly. In the course of just a few hours, Cullen was left alone to parent their four young children. We're talking today about her experience of grief and sudden single parenthood, what she learned, how she got through it, and how it shaped her as a person, and lessons she hopes to share with others. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. We want to hear about your expressions of grief, sudden loss, and single parenthood. What was grief like for you? What was the hardest part? What helped you get through it? What advice would you have for people who are newly grieving? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Gail Garbarino Cullen is a longtime TV and radio reporter in Milwaukee. She's the author of the book Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. Gail, thanks for joining us today.
I'm really pleased to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
I understand you started to write this book because you were looking for a book like this and it wasn't out there for you. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, I mean, I was young. I was 41 years old and I had these four little girls and all of a sudden my husband was snatched away from our lives. And I was really looking for something to read. I'm a big reader and something that could give me a sense of direction or some idea of what lie ahead. And I really was struggling to find anything. There's a lot of books about grief and a lot of, you know, meditations and things like that, but I really wasn't finding anything that specifically related to my circumstance as a young widow and a newly single mother. And so I kind of said to myself at the time, when I have time, which would be a little ways down the road, that I was going to write such a book. And that's what Owning Grief has become.
And your story is, I think, any married person and parent's nightmare. Can you talk about your unexpected loss of Steve?
Sure. Steve was 40 years old and a pretty healthy individual. I mean, we ate our share of pizza and other not so healthy foods, but for the most part, a pretty healthy guy. He was a runner. He had done many marathons and, in fact, had run a marathon just 3 days before he died. And then, you know, he was away on a business trip and was supposed to pick up my youngest daughter on a given day after school, and I would pick up the other kids, and he didn't show up. And he was due back from his business trip, and I was kind of curious. And bottom line was, after many phone calls, I discovered that he had been found dead in his hotel room. And the ultimate autopsy couldn't really tell me definitively, but their best guess is that it was a sudden cardiac arrhythmia, essentially like a switch that flipped and his heart just quit.
And now your life, of course you're dealing with the grief from the loss of Steve. You're raising four kids, doing all the stuff that goes into that, but by yourself now, so you're figuring that out. And you're dealing with your kids' grief. These are young kids. I don't know how you did it. Can you talk just a little bit about how overwhelming that must have been?
Yeah, well, the kids were ages 3 to 9, so very little. And even trying to get them to understand that their dad wasn't coming home and why that was challenging, to say the least. And then, as you said, dealing with their grief as well as my own and still trying to put one foot in front of the other and get them back on track as far as school and soccer and life, while still trying to deal with my own grief and my own loss and the enormous responsibility that every parent feels of trying to raise your kids. And then suddenly having that responsibility quadrupled, I think, because I was now doing it absolutely alone without my life's partner. So it was huge. And it was a daily thing with grief. Certainly time helps a lot. And anybody who's lost anyone knows that over the course of time, it becomes a little bit more something you can deal with and a little less painful. But I can tell you, you know, I'm 27 years out from Steve's loss and I don't think about him every single day. I don't bemoan the fact that he's not here. I have moved on in my life. I have my daughters now have kids of their own, so I have grandchildren, and life is really good. But there are still times, and I ran into those even in writing this book, that some of that overwhelming sense of loss came smack back in my face again when I would sit down to write about it. So it's not something, you know, some people that maybe haven't experienced grief or a death of a close friend or a close loved one may not fully get the idea. You don't just get over it. The person that you lost, hopefully, was so important and significant in your life, and in my case, in my life and in my kids' lives, that's not something that you get past that. You figure out ways to move forward and to gain things from that, which I do believe we all have gained things, have found some gifts in this loss. But it's one of those things that you just don't, you know, okay, it's day 8 or it's week 7. Now you're done. Move on. It doesn't work that way.
We're talking to Gail Garbarino-Cullen. Her new book is Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. It's about the loss of her husband. She's a longtime Milwaukee journalist. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question, maybe an experience of your own to share with us. That's 800-642-1234. Josh joins us now in Marshfield. Josh, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Josh?
Well, I was just listening in, and I just wanted to say my experience of grief, especially during the holidays. So what happened like 5 years ago was my grandma, who was 95 at the time, was dying and just letting go. And fortunately, we did have this experience of her passing during Christmas, and I think I was really just mad during that time because no one told me beforehand when I was going home for Christmas, and unfortunately she died, and I just felt really just devastated, even though I knew it was her time to go, and she was kind of allowing us to have that time to go. I was just mad afterwards just because no one was honest. And I kind of had to process my own grief for it and just anger towards it. And kind of during this whole COVID, I kind of thanked that experience because it kind of inoculated me into seeing a lot of people, you know, unfortunately dying from COVID. And I just want to say it's hard.
Josh, I hear you, and I'm sorry for that difficult experience. That said, Gail, you talk about the complicated emotions that come along with guilt, and you have a reading for us related to Josh was talking about anger there, and this is what you're talking about here. Can you share that with us?
Absolutely, Josh. You're right on the money. Anger is certainly one of those emotions that you go through and that you keep going through periodically after the loss of someone. And this is part of what I wrote in my book. Exhausted by the day, the dinner hour, and the rituals of getting 4 kids tucked into bed, appropriate stories read, and nighttime prayers said, I wanted nothing more than to sit down and put my feet up. And then the snow. As I trudged outdoors at nearly 10 p.m. to clear the sidewalk and the ever-so-long driveway by hand for the umpteenth time, I was angry. You should be here doing this, I shouted into the winter sky, not caring if any neighbor was witnessing this slightly crazed woman in her snow-filled driveway. This is your job, not mine. Tears streamed down my cheeks with each shovelful of the heavy, cold annoyance. Steve had always taken care of the outdoor chores that came with owning a house. I handled so much of what needed to happen inside that it seemed a good working compromise. How dare he leave me and dump this wet, sloppy, heavy burden on me? Of course, it wasn't really about the snow. It was yet another slap in the face, as if I needed it, reminding me that the house, the kids, the financial worries, everything sat squarely in my lap. Steve was not there to shoulder any of the myriad responsibilities. The one who for 17 years had been by my side was noticeably, prominently, permanently, awfully absent. He hadn't asked for this, but neither had I.
And that, I love that you included that in the book, because I think people, as in the way they talk about grief, they might not want to talk about that the anger and the other difficult emotions that they might not be willing to admit. Why was that important for you to share?
Well, you know, it does seem, how can you blame the person who's gone? They didn't do anything. It's not their fault. But it's just a very natural emotion that you encounter. And in fact, it was interesting when I sat down to actually physically write this. You know, a lot of memoirs tend to be, you know, I was born here, I grew up here, I was raised here, I did that, you know, kind of very chronological. And I sat down to write this, and it was like, I can't write this chronologically. It doesn't make sense because I would be I was very angry at the beginning, but there were many other moments along the way, and there have been along the way, you know, that I was angry again. And these emotions would kind of ride this wave, this roller coaster. It's like, how do I write about this? And so that's why I decided to write the book more from an emotional perspective. Anger is certainly a huge part of grief, anxiety, fear. A lot of those things keep cropping back up again and again and again. And so to write them and at more about how the emotion of that moment was or those moments, and then relate to how I overcame them, how I moved past them in that moment, and then, you know, would find them jumping up and hitting me in the face again here and there.
We're talking to longtime Milwaukee reporter Gail Garbarino-Cullen about her memoir, Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. You can join in if you have a question for Gail about dealing with grief, maybe an experience to share. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with longtime Milwaukee reporter Gail Garbarino-Cullen about her memoir. It's called Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. Go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, I understand you have a story to share with us.
Yes, I lost my little boy Matthew when he was about 6 and a half, and it was sudden. And one of the things that I experienced was that I had built this whole network of support people around me, his teachers, his doctors, he had some disabilities. And when he died, I felt like I lost all that support, all those people that had helped me get through parenting him. And one of the things that helped me the most, besides having a good therapist, was going to Compassionate Friends, a support group for people who had a child die.
Okay, I'm so sorry for that loss, and thank you for being willing to share that with us. Gail, some common themes there, finding that kind of support, therapy as needed. Can you talk about your own experiences?
Well, and Kay, you're right on the money as far as, you know, a lot of people have a hard time dealing with grief, or they think that, okay, well, the person's passed, so now I don't need to be a part of the survivor's life anymore. And that is so hard. And I certainly experienced that. My kids experienced that too. There were certain friends that had been so close to us, and after my husband passed away, they disappeared. And I think some of that is people not knowing how to cope with the grief, not knowing, you know, if the physical sight of you as the survivor can trigger their own loss, their own sadness about the loss of your son in this case, or my husband in my case, that they'd prefer to just cut off that relationship and not go there. And that's really, really challenging. But I think you were wise to find other ways to go about that. I always thought of myself, even before my husband passed away, as sort of, you know, this strong mother that could just take on the world and handle anything. And then this happened to me, and it was clear that I couldn't do it alone. And finding the people that were really, truly good friends, even some new friends that I didn't know that I would run into. And that's what you're talking about with the grief group that you attended. Finding those people and reaching out to people that you do know who have stood by you and will stand by you. That's such a huge, huge part of coping with the grief and dealing with the loss and moving forward. Not moving past, moving forward in your life.
Okay, thanks again for sharing that story. I wanted to ask you, Gail, about the best ways for people to help. There's some people who seem just really good and they know what to do. And there's people, I'll admit, like me, who might say something vague like, let me know if I can help, which I think is probably not very helpful. How can we move somebody like me into that better category?
Well, I think that's fair. And, that, you know, grief is such a hard thing to deal with. It's so hard. Death is a hard thing to deal with. And so it's hard to know when you go to a funeral and there's the grieving widow or mother or father or whoever, and to go up to them and know, what do you say? What could possibly be helpful? And you don't want to not say something. It's just really a predicament. And I think for me personally, one of the things that I found the most helpful was when people would not be afraid to talk to me, not be afraid to talk about my husband, maybe tell even a funny story, a funny memory that they had of him, something that was meaningful to me to hear, and that they shared that with me. And that was so much better than just a generic, let me know how I can help, see ya. You know? And I think that really helps a lot. And to not be afraid of causing the person who's grieving to cry. Crying is absolutely normal, absolutely a part of grief. It's not a bad thing. And so, yeah, you might bring some tears to my eyes when you mention some fun or funny story of Steve that I didn't know. But what a wonderful joy that is for me to hear that story. A lot of people came forward after Steve died and wrote or told me personally of some anecdotes, some ways that he had touched their lives, that many of which I had never known about. And that was a wonderful gift that they shared with me. And I think if we can all, in trying to help others with their grief, try to even find just a single little moment of what that person meant to you and share that with the family that's grieving, I think that can go a long way toward helping them with their loss.
Talking to Gail Garbarino-Cullen, her new book is Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. We'll go now to Wendy with us in Oconomowoc. Wendy, hi.
Hello. My husband died after almost.
Oh, I'm sorry, Wendy. We've got a bad connection. I'm so sorry. Thank you for being willing to share your story, though. We'll go to John in Mason. John, hi.
Oh, I'm just calling to say I saw a meme that explains how the feeling of loss changes over time. It was a meme with three jars, a small, medium, and large, and the jars represented us. The grief inside the jar stayed the same. It didn't diminish at all, but we changed. We adapted and we grew around the grief.
John, thank you so much. And John, this sets up what I was going to ask to talk to you about in the last few minutes, Gail, so very well. You talk about post-traumatic growth in the book, which I think John really hit the nail on the head. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. And I had never heard that term before. I was well into writing the book when I stumbled upon some article on the internet about post-traumatic growth. And as I was reading what that was, it was like, oh my goodness, this is what I'm writing about. I thought people would think I was slightly off my rocker when I wrote that there were gifts in loss. There were positive things that came out of losing my husband. That doesn't mean that I'm glad he's gone, but there certainly have been some wonderful gifts that have resulted from that, including my growth in my own career, my relationship with my daughters. We have an annual run and walk that we host every year to support cardiac research in my husband's memory. A lot of really positive, growing things that have resulted from Steve's death. And I think, John, you're right on the money. That meme is perfect because, yeah, your grief doesn't go away. It doesn't diminish, but you grow so much that you become better able, better equipped to handle it and to live with it and to blossom even as a result.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Gail, can you take a couple minutes to speak to, I think, your main intended audience, someone out there who's maybe dealing with a loss, maybe very recent, maybe in the last couple of years? Share something a little more from your experience that might help them out.
You know, it's so hard in the moment, and that could be, you know, the month or the weeks or the first year or whatever surrounding the death of someone that we love. It's so hard to think beyond that there is more after that, that there is something to hope for. But I can tell you from my own experience, if you can open yourself up to the support of others and to the willingness to find some things that maybe are not the worst thing about this. As I mentioned briefly, my relationship with my daughters, I think they are all so strong and so unwilling to sweat the small stuff in so many ways. And I think that's a gift from having lived without their dad. And that sounds a little weird, but I think if you are able and at least open to seeing when there maybe is something positive that can come from this, that there really is the ability to find a greater you around that grief that will make you a more whole person again, and that you can grow and develop and really own the grief.
And I'm looking at the website, CullenRun.com, for that Steve Cullen Healthy Heart Club run/walk funds research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. A great tribute. Can you encourage people to participate?
Absolutely. Come on out. This is our 27th year. Steve's been gone for 27 years. And to date, we've raised over $600,000 for heart research. You know, it's a wonderful thing that we have been able to come up with a way to memorialize Steve, but also do something really good with the money. The research that we fund is truly groundbreaking, and it's an incredible tribute to him, and I think to my girls and my family that we put this on every year, and that literally hundreds of people come out and join us and help support the cause.
Gail, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Gail Garbarino Cullen, longtime TV and radio reporter in Milwaukee. Her new book is Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. That website again, CullenRun.com. Tomorrow on Central Time, Food Friday, inspiration from Native American cooking traditions, that and more. Tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act aimed to provide a legal status for some undocumented farm workers. It's falling short in the U.S. Senate. We'll find out what impact it could have had. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Ukrainian President Zelensky is heading home after a surprise visit to Washington, D.C. yesterday. We'll talk about his meeting with President Biden and what he said to a joint meeting of Congress. First, some lawmakers have been making the case in recent years for the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, a bill that could eventually lead to a legal status for undocumented farm workers in the U.S. There was a last-ditch effort to pass the legislation as part of a year-end omnibus spending bill. Looks like it didn't make it, though. As some farmers struggled to retain workers, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act was aimed at helping farmers who need year-long help as well as seasonal help around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you operate a farm yourself, do you rely on workers from other countries, undocumented or otherwise? Were you watching the progress of this law? Whoever you are, wherever you are, what do you want to know about the status of farm workers in the country, what this act could have done, other changes that could be in the works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Costa is the Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. He focuses on U.S. immigration law and policy, international labor migration, farm labor, and forced migration. Daniel, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's been this Farm Workforce Modernization Act has been in the works over the course of a few years. We've talked to you about it before. There was this last-minute push between, I think, when we reached out to you and today. What ended up happening in the home stretch?
Sure. It appears there just weren't enough senators that were willing to support the legislation because of the filibuster rules in the Senate. You needed at least 10 Republican senators to support it. And from all the reporting that's out there, it's just clear they didn't have enough. It seems like they came close. Maybe they had six or seven senators who supported it, but they couldn't get all the weight of 10, and thus it didn't get a standalone vote. It didn't have the votes to get attached to the omnibus spending package that just passed the Senate.
Give us the basics. What would the Farm Workforce Modernization Act do if it were to be passed?
Sure. It has three main elements. The first one is a legalization program for unauthorized immigrant farm workers. There's some work requirements, and it would take a number of years before they could get a green card, but it would give unauthorized farm workers an immediate kind of temporary status so they could continue to work. Sure. A second piece is it would make major changes to the H-2A visa program, which is the U.S.'s main temporary work visa program. One of the bigger changes is that it would include new visas for year-rounds. And it would make a number of changes to kind of the way the wages rule, the wages work in that program. And then finally, it would mandate the E-Verify program for agricultural employers nationwide. That is the federal government's electronic employment verification program. So there's a whole lot within those three buckets, but that's kind of the overarching broad framework of the legislation.
That year-round thing, it's of interest here in Wisconsin, as I understand it, and I think from past conversations with you, Daniel, a lot of the law surrounding this regards seasonal labor, kind of important in Wisconsin, more important elsewhere. Dairy states like Wisconsin, there's no dairy season, or it's always dairy season. Can you talk about that non-seasonal part of the legislation?
Yeah, sure. And I should say, I actually grew up in a dairy town, had a lot of family members who worked on dairy. So I know the importance of the industry. And I mean, in Wisconsin, there are about 15 to 20,000 dairy workers on about I think it's about 1,200 dairy farms, at least according to the Labor Department's latest numbers. And
I'm going to cut in. Daniel, we're having some connection trouble. I think we're going to try reconnecting through another medium with you. We are talking to Daniel Costa with the Economic Policy Institute. We're looking at farm labor in the United States, undocumented farm laborers in particular, and a bill. It's been bouncing around in Congress for a while now. A version had passed the House. There was a last-ditch effort to pass it in this omnibus spending package. Didn't end up in there, though. The bill is the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, looking to provide some kind of legal status for those undocumented farm workers. It fell short. We're finding out why, what it means, what could happen next. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I think we're reconnected with Daniel. We lost you there, Daniel. The question you were tackling was the importance of that's non-seasonal, that year-round element of the Farm Workforce Modernization Act.
Sure. I was saying that that element of the bill is something that not just is important for Wisconsin, but a number of states have been lobbying and pushing for changes to the H-2A program in order to have year-round jobs. And so there are something like about 500,000 ag jobs nationwide. And so the way the bill worked is it started with kind of a low number, kind of an annual limit on the number of year-round jobs that the H-2A could fill. It would start at 20,000 for the first 3 years, and then it would go up by a certain number, and then after the 10th year, it might not have a limit anymore. So that was one of the most controversial aspects of the bill. It's one of the things that the employers wanted more of. There was some back and forth. I think one of the issues that kind of came up in this is that you're doing temporary visas for what are year-round jobs, and many, especially worker advocates, think that if you're bringing migrants in to do year-round jobs, they should get green cards and permanent residence, because that way they could stay permanently and work year-round rather than being in this temporary status that employers control.
Let's take a step back and look at the role of farm workers from other countries, documented or otherwise. How important are these workers in American agriculture?
They're absolutely essential. I mean, they make up probably something like 3/4 to 80% of the entire farm workforce is immigrants of either who are either undocumented or coming in on visas or who were naturalized immigrants. So it's very much a very immigrant-heavy industry. The industry really wouldn't function without immigrants. It's probably only somewhere between 20% and 30% of people who are U.S. born actually work in agriculture, and it's been that way for some time. I think that what's happened sort of over the years is there used to be a very much there was a higher share of the workforce was undocumented, but with all the border security that's happened over the previous years, what you've seen is a shift to using this H-2A visa program, which farmers have started to use in record numbers. We're up past 300,000 H-2A workers in the United States. That's more than triple what it was just about a decade ago.
Can you talk about some of the political alignments here? What kind of organizations, what kind of groups were advocating for this Farm Workforce Modernization Act and this more legal status for agricultural workers from other countries?
Sure. Well, you had some splits among the groups that supported it on either side. You know, groups who were out there either pushing for or against it were the major kind of agricultural associations that are out there, the Western Growers, the American Farm Bureau, and then kind of on the worker side, it was mostly the United Farm Workers who were negotiating this with farm owners. And there were some farm worker groups that didn't like the bill as much because of the expansion of the H-2A program, which many people, including myself, think is sort of flawed in the way that it's set up in terms of giving employers a lot of power over workers. And so it really both the support and the opposition to it was kind of split in terms of politically. Almost all Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, supported the bill, and you even had statements of support from President Biden, who supported the legislation as well and wanted its passage. So there was a lot of support for it. It's one of those bills where even under the Trump administration, there was a chance that it might pass, just because agriculture is such an important industry, and every single senator in the United States has agriculture in their state, and so that gives it a chance to pass. Even though there are green cards and a legalization in there, which some Republicans think they call amnesty, and they have been against it mostly for that reason.
Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Good afternoon. I just had a question. What do these workers get paid, and do they have housing involved? Because I guess I understand why they can't get regular citizens that are already here to do the work. Is it the conditions are so poor that you pay us so? I just wondered about that.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. That is kind of at the heart of this. Why aren't American workers or people here already legally filling these jobs to begin with, Daniel?
Sure, yes. It's a great question, and it's one of the issues that's at the heart of the debate about this legislation. So farm workers in general are amongst the lowest paid workers in the entire U.S. labor market. One of the things that employers were claiming in terms of the need for this legislation was that wages are rising too quickly in agriculture, and they have risen maybe a little bit faster than regular than wages for other workers outside of agriculture. But the reality is that they have not even come close to getting to where wages are for other workers who are outside of agriculture. So still some of the lowest wages in the entire U.S. labor market, right around the wages that workers who do not have a high school diploma earn. And so the H-2A workers who come in on visas, there are federal laws and regulations that set what those wages are set at. Each state has a different wage, and the way the wage is set is just by looking at survey data for agricultural farm workers that the USDA puts out every year. So every year there's a new wage, which is the wages that the employer is required to pay. And so in the legislation, in the bill, what the bill did is freeze the increase in wages for these H-2A farm workers for a year, and then it set limits on how quickly their wages could rise. And that was one of the things that employers wanted the most. But, it really you know, one of the things, one of my criticisms of the bill is that it really restricts wage growth that should happen naturally for farm workers when there is, you know, a supposed labor shortage. You would expect wages to rise naturally, and that legislation really did a lot to not let those wages increase. Oh, and then the last thing, of course, is the H-2A program does require that employers provide housing for their H-2A workers, as well as transportation. And U.S. workers, if they apply for those jobs, are also entitled to that same wage and to that same housing and transportation if they live outside of the local area.
Thanks for that call, Jimmy. Daniel Costa is with us, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. We're talking with him about immigrant farm labor and the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which just fell short in the U.S. Senate this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Even though this failed this time around, would you like to see more access to legal status for farm workers from other countries here in the U.S., maybe those who are already working here but are undocumented? Do you work in agriculture yourself? Do you see a lot of undocumented workers in the business there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. We're looking at farm labor in the United States, workers from other countries, often undocumented workers, key to agriculture here in the United States, and about the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, an effort to provide more access to legal status for some of those workers. It fell short in this big Senate year-end last-minute spending bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences. Maybe you've worked with or hired some of the workers we're talking about. Maybe you are one of the workers we're talking about. And even if you're not, you probably eat food once in a while. You may have an opinion on all of this. What do you want to see happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel, you were talking before the break about labor costs for farmers. It's tricky because this is not a high margin industry. For a dairy farmer, say, well, milk prices, if they go up, great. But often that means feed prices have gone up. Labor prices have gone up with inflation lately. There's not a lot of wiggle room for some of the employers we're talking about.
Sure, that's true. And even with when you're talking about crops and fresh produce and things like that, you know, the markup is often at the grocery store, and farmers and workers are getting small margins here, and that's absolutely understandable. But the solution to me is not to restrict and push down wages of workers who are already some of the lowest earners in the entire labor market. Of course, there needs to be a fairer way to do that. But of course, employers need to make a profit in order for their business to work and to be able to keep employing people. So how you come up with that, what that balance is obviously something that needs to be figured out by Congress. That one solution was the way the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, but there are probably other ways to do it, too.
I wanted to ask you about that, given that this year the Farm Workforce Modernization Act isn't going to happen. Congress is done. There's questions about whether it could happen now with the Republicans taking control of the House next month. Do you see other avenues to tackle some of these concerns?
At the moment, it's not looking like it. If it requires legislation that comes from Congress, I find it very hard to believe, unless it's something that doesn't include immigration or doesn't include legalization or doesn't include green cards for immigrants. I think the Republican-led House is just not going to entertain any issues like that at all, and I think that's why people were working very hard in Congress to try to get this attached either to the omnibus or to get a vote on it before the end of the year, because it's pretty clear that nothing along those lines is even going to be considered, really.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Eau Claire. Matt, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about, Matt?
Oh, I was just, here's what I want to bring to your attention, or whatever have you. I'm a tradesman, and I learned my work ethic in 120-degree hay mound when I was a kid, you know, because that's the job that you had when you were 14 years old. And I'm just wondering, your comments as far as this subject goes, as far as why are those jobs not available to young men indigenous to this country? You know,
Matt, thanks for the call. Yeah, I don't know if farmers are looking for those teen workers for that kind of grueling, demanding work, Daniel.
Yes, I mean the under sort of the H-2A program, employers are supposed to recruit and hire U.S. workers before they can go and hire someone from abroad, and that's an essential element of the program and should remain so. I think it's tough to say. It's just been hard to attract U.S. workers to the jobs because of the low wages that I've mentioned, the low wages and the very tough conditions. I mean, farm work is you know, by the numbers, some of the most dangerous work in the entire U.S. labor market, while being the lowest paid. So you can see that employers have been you know, willing to the other workforce that's available to them is to go abroad. And so, I would like to see a world where conditions get improved and some more U.S. workers might want to take these jobs. But I'm not sure to what extent you could get there and what it would require in terms of improving wages and working conditions. But I do think that improving wages and working conditions would at least attract some workers, because many people think that that no Americans do these jobs, and that's just not true. The data from the Labor Department show that, you know, depending on the year, it might be 20 or might be 30% of the farm workers are actually U.S. born workers. So some probably would do these jobs if conditions were improved, but that's been an ongoing long-standing problem in agriculture.
Thanks for the call. Todd joins us now in Stevens Point. Todd, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Todd. You're on the air.
I was just questioning. You mentioned the lowest wages, but I didn't hear an actual number. And then you also mentioned the farmer employer needs to provide the housing. Is that housing on the premises of the farm? Or where exactly do they house the employees? And third question is, do these people pay taxes?
Todd, thanks for the call. I'm guessing the answer to the first two questions, Daniel, is going to vary around the country, the rate of pay and the housing. But do we have a sense of how those work out?
Sure. So I don't know what it is for Wisconsin. I'm sorry, I should check that. But nationwide, it's around $16 an hour was the wage for farm workers. And to put that into context, almost every single Democrat in the House and Senate thinks that $15 should be the minimum wage across the board for everyone. So it's just above, the minimum wage is even, higher than that in some states. And so that's the broadly the wages. And then in terms of the housing, it varies. You can have the housing on premises. Some employers do actually build housing on their location, or they often rent out entire hotels where they keep workers. It varies, and the state is involved in checking to make sure that the housing is up to federal standards. There are rules about the minimum standards for the housing. And in terms of taxes, that varies by state. A couple of states, including California, you do need to pay payroll taxes on H-2A workers, but federally you don't. So in a number of states, you actually don't have to pay the taxes on them.
Thanks for the questions, Todd. And Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. He focuses on U.S. immigration law and policy, international labor migration, farm labor, and forced migration. He joined us today to talk about the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. It didn't make it through a threshold at the U.S. Senate, not going to pass, it looks like, this year. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.